and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium at the University of Alaska Anchorage for Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson's talk on the largest U.S. migration. Author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration, Isabel Wilkerson was recorded speaking at UAA on January 26th.
Well, good evening. On this, considered bitterly cold evening. I'm so happy to see so many people out today. It is an honor to be here in Alaska. I came all the way from Atlanta, Georgia, to be here. That's a long way. And it was a little bit warmer than here. And yet I'm delighted to be here. I think that I'm visible from wherever I go because I think I have multiple layers on, and people must be saying to themselves, she must clearly be from someplace else because she's overdressed. I have to say that I'm so thrilled to be here for multiple reasons. I spent 15 years working on the book, The Warmth of Other Suns. This is my copy. So you can see, it looks a little different from whatever copy you may have, whether you get it today or whether you have it already. It almost looks like it's 15 years old, but it is not. It's actually just a year. This book is literally, this version of it is just a year old. But I have been all over the country talking about this book, and it seems so fitting that I come to Alaska. The more I've learned about the history of Alaska, how fitting it is to be here in a place where literally everyone here is by definition someone who came a long way away just to be here. Someone, whether it's someone in the room or someone many, many generations ago, had to journey very far to get here. And that is the story of the people in this book. The people in this book and the people of the Great Migration are, in fact, proxies for someone in all of our backgrounds who had to have done what the people in this book did just for us to be here at this place, at this time, on this soil, right now, because that is what human beings do when they're looking for something better than where they happen to be. And so this great migration that I've written about is in some ways an homage. It's a sense of honoring people who had the courage to risk everything that they had to go to a place that they had never seen and to leave the only place that they'd ever known for someplace far, far away, not knowing what the future might hold, no guarantees whatsoever of what might be ahead for them, and yet they did it anyway. And I want to talk a little bit about this migration, because this migration is it was the largest internal migration within our history's in the history of our country. It was the only time that American citizens had to leave the land of their birth for another place within the borders of their own country merely to be recognized as the citizens to which they had been born. That's the only time that American citizens have had to do this. And so therefore, it holds a special place in our history, but of course, it also holds a special place in that it's so inspiring for all of us wherever we might happen to be and whatever journey might have led to our being where we are. Now, I'll give you a little bit of background on this migration. This Great Migration involved 6 million Americans, 6 million African Americans who left the South and went all points north, midwest, and west. And before coming to Alaska, I used to always get a round of laughter whenever I would tell people that when people really wanted to get away, they went to Seattle. But I think I have to change that. I think I might need to say that when people really wanted to get away, they came to Alaska. And to give you a little sense of the circumstances of the people who were part of this migration, I think that when we speak about a great migration, we are on the cusp of what is considered to be Black History Month. We have just finished, the formal honoring of Martin Luther King's birthday, and I know that that's what today's event is also in honor of. And so as a result of that, it's necessary to note that this migration was not simply a move for people. This was, in fact, a defection. This was, in fact, a seeking of political asylum of American citizens to find a place within their own country where they could be recognized as citizens. So this was, in some ways, a defection, not merely a move. And what were they defecting from? What was it that they ultimately had to flee? What they had to flee was a world and a caste system which is almost unimaginable to us today. They were in many respects fleeing an artificial hierarchy that determined what a person could and could not do, what kind of work they could do, whether they could go to school, how many months of the year they could go to school, and every single aspect of their lives, from the moment that they woke up until the moment that they went to sleep, based upon what they looked like. And this, the caste into which one had to endure was determined upon birth. So that meant that there was no escaping the predetermined role that you were going to be assigned to when you were born in the South, regardless of your race, Black or white. There were defined roles that everyone had. And this caste system was so arcane that it actually made it was actually against the law in the city of Birmingham, Alabama, for a Black person and a white person to merely play checkers together. It was against the law. Throughout the South, in courtrooms throughout the South, there was actually a Black Bible and an altogether different white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. That meant that the very word of God was segregated. There's actually a Jim Crow Bible. And the way that I found out about that was I was in the course of working on this book is about this great migration, clearly, and it's primarily told through the stories of three people, three protagonists who left different parts of the South or different parts of the rest of the country. And in order to make it come alive, in order to give it resonance and to give it context, I had to do all this additional research. And one of the things that I had to do was I had to go and look at newspapers and other documents from the era. And in doing so, I ran across this article that ran in one of the newspapers in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I stopped in my tracks when I saw the headline, which made reference to a Jim Crow Bible, and I thought, how in the world could you have a Jim Crow Bible? And it turned out that this was a story about the fact that there were Black and white Bibles in courtrooms, but not with a sense of alarm or embarrassment or shame, none whatsoever. In fact, it wasn't announcing that there were going to be Black Bibles and white Bibles in courtrooms. No, the reason why this had made the news was because on that particular day, there had been a trial in session, and the trial had to be suspended, disrupted, because they could not find the Black Bible for the witness who had taken the stand. They couldn't find the Bible. And so that meant that the bailiff and the sheriff and the court officers all had to stop what they were doing and to comb the courthouse in order to find the Bible so that this witness could swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help them God, but also so that the trial could resume. And that is one of the realities that people lived under, and shows you how this could disrupt at any moment the normal course of events for people in that time. But this was not described as some bizarre or arcane situation. It was described as just the normal way that life should be, and no one seemed to be questioning it at that time. I've since been asked if they were different versions of the Bible, for maybe there would be the King James Version for the white eyewitnesses, and then there'd be maybe the Gideon Bible or the American Standard for the Black people. But they were the same version of the Bible. It was the King James Version. They just could not touch the same sacred object, and that was the point. Now, I've had the chance to... in talking about this arcane world that I had to recreate for the book, and which did not happen centuries ago, but happened within the lifespan of many people who are alive today. I've been all over the country talking about this, and I find that my most challenging, delightfully challenging audiences happen to be high school students because they're so removed from this that they simply cannot believe it. They just have the hardest time accepting that this actually was a reality not that long ago. And so I happened to find myself in Hawaii, in a high school, talking to high school students there. And I want to share with you the reaction that I got to one specific example that I gave to the students. Before I tell you what that example was, I'd like to see if I might get a show of hands. I know the weather has been challenging because there's still snow on the ground clearly here, but I know that many of you have had to drive to get here, and you drive probably every day or so. And I'd like to see if you might be willing to acknowledge if you've done the what I'm about to ask in the last month. I'll give you a month. How many of you have within the last month done the following? And that is, you've been driving your car and you find yourself overtaking someone in front of you, another car, and you decide to pass them on the road. How many have done that in the last month? Surely, I mean, you may have done it on the way here, I would think. I know I did it on the way to the airport. It's a normal course of events for us today. If you were African-American, however, during the era that I'm describing, which would have been from the beginning of the 20th century well into the 1960s and early even 1970s, it was actually against the law and against protocol for an African-American in many parts of the South, an African-American driver, to pass a white motorist on the road, no matter how slowly that person was going. I'm going to repeat that. No matter, it was actually against the law and against protocol for an African-American motorist to pass a white motorist on the road, no matter how slowly that person was going. Now, I interviewed over 1,200 people for this book, and I had to read many, many, many accounts during that era in order to write this book. However, what I just told you came from multiple sources, from anthropologists and sociologists who did work at that time, repeated. I kept seeing it over and over and over again, and I could not believe it. And yet, this was the normal course of events for African Americans. This is the world that they had to live under. So I found myself telling this to a room full of high school students in Honolulu. And they absolutely were not having it. They just could not believe that. Now, remember, they're just now getting their driver's licenses, so this is a complete affront to everything they believe in. And so I was getting this pushback from them, and they were saying, I heard this murmuring in the back, and I said, what is it that you all are saying back there? And one student raised his hand and said, well, I would have honked. And I had to say, now, let me start again. If the people could not pass the other individuals on the road, you most certainly could not honk either. You couldn't honk to make them go faster. And so they were conversing a little bit before because they were upset about that too. And so I heard them continuing to murmur, and I said, what else is it that you're saying? And another one raised his hand and said, well, I would have tailgated. I wouldn't have made any noise. I just would have tailgated to let them know that they needed to move faster. And I said, now, if you could not pass the people on the road and you couldn't honk, you couldn't tailgate either. In other words, you could not make these people move any faster than you thought they should. You had to stay in your place. And so then there was another hand that went up, and that student said, well, I would have left then. And I said, my point exactly. That is what 6 million people did as a result of their decision to not live under the thumb of an arcane and bizarre, actually, a caste system. Now, you know, we find it kind of amusing, actually, that students would react this way to one of the daily injustices that had to be endured by so many generations of African Americans during that time period. But I have to give you the sobering reality that while the students and we ourselves now may look upon this as just arcane and bizarre, this was a deadly serious world in which they were living. Any breach of the caste system could actually mean the lives of people who dared to or mistakenly broke the rules of this caste system. Every 4 days, an African American was lynched for some perceived breach of the caste system in the decades leading up to this migration and in the immediate decade after the migration began. And the reason for a lynching, the most common reason for a lynching was not the well-known situation such as that of Emmett Till, who had been accused of untoward remark that was made, that he was accused of having made to a white Southern woman in Mississippi in the 1950s. The more common reason for lynching was for the amorphous and ambiguous charge of having acted like a white person. And that could mean anything, not stepping off the sidewalk fast enough, moving to be served before it was your time to be served. Anything that could be viewed as being out of your place could actually mean your life. And so this was a very serious world that the people were living in, indeed. Now, this migration that I've described to you, you might wonder, well, what is it that started this and what were the years that this occurred? The migration began, this great migration began during World War I. And that's because during World War I, the North had a big problem. The North had a problem. When I say North, I mean primarily the northeastern part of the United States had a big problem. Now, the problem was one of labor, which had been the problem that the South had, which is how this whole caste system began in the first place. The caste system that I described to you began as a result of the fact that the South needed, expected, and relied upon not just a supply of cheap labor, but an oversupply of cheap labor. The economy of any particular political entity often is what drives much of the policy that people have to live under. And so the same goes for the South. And so the South required an oversupply of cheap labor in order to maintain its economy. Remember, this is an economy that was built upon the need to have the agriculture tended in the way that was necessary to keep the economy going. So that means that they needed to have people out there to plant, to chop, to tend, and to harvest the cotton, the sugar cane, the rice, and the tobacco that were the lifeblood of the South. And they needed to have people who were there at the ready for the times when it was the land would be fallow and they needed to be sitting there waiting for the land to need to have the people come out and do the work of maintaining the crops that were the lifeblood of the South. And so that meant that there had to be people more than were necessary to be there and to feel as if they had no option but to stay, not having any alternatives but to stay and to work the land. And thus came this rigid and arcane and brutal regime ultimately that maintained the system. Now, what broke all of this was the fact that during World War I, it was the North that had a labor problem. And the North had a labor problem because Europe was at war, and that meant that immigration from Europe came to a virtual halt. And the immigration from Europe was what had been feeding and maintaining the foundries and the factories and the steel mills and the railroads of the North. And when Europe was at war, that meant that they didn't have the people to turn to in order to keep those factories and foundries going. And so what did the North do? The North looked to the cheapest labor in the land, which meant African Americans in the South, many of whom were not being paid for their labor at all. They were sharecroppers. They were working for the right to live on the land that they were farming. And so therefore, they were ripe for recruitment. And that meant that the very first African Americans who arrived in the North, the Northeast primarily and the Midwest, arrived at the express invitation of people of the companies and the powers that be in the North. Now, when these people began to leave, they began to leave in World War I, the South began to recognize that it had a big problem. They needed these people, and yet they were beginning to leave. And so I'm going to read to you very quickly Very short passage, very short comment, actually, from that says so much about how the South was responding to this. And this is coming from a newspaper in Macon, Georgia, where people were beginning to recognize that this was a problem that was going to jeopardize the economy of the South and the culture of the South and the way of life that the South was depending upon. And this is what this person wrote. Everybody seems to be asleep about what's going on right under our noses. That is, everybody but those farmers who have wakened up on mornings recently to find every Negro over 21 on his place gone. To Cleveland, to Pittsburgh, to Chicago, to Indianapolis. And while our very solvency, listen to the language of the era, while our very solvency is being sucked out beneath us, we go on about our affairs as usual. So there was a great hand-wringing and churning and worry and anxiety about what was happening because these people were leaving and they had no way of controlling the people who were leaving. And so what did they decide to do? What the South began to do was to try to keep them from leaving anyway. What they would do is that they would arrest people from the railroad platforms, people who were seeking to get to a place of freedom away from where they happened to have been born. They would arrest people from the train seats. And when there were too many people to arrest, they would wave the train on through so that people who had been saving up for months and months or even longer had to watch that train to what they perceived as freedom leave without them and then figure out how now will we get out. And yet that effort, the effort by the South to control the fleeing of these people actually only fed the desire to leave. It had the exact opposite effect because it was clear to the people that the world that they were in was not going to change anytime soon. I'll give you a couple of examples of other things that they did. One thing that they did is that they also tried to control the demand side of this equation, meaning trying to keep the corporations in the North from coming in and recruiting African-American workers. So the way that they did this is they began to create these laws that would make it all but impossible for someone to come in and to recruit. In Macon, Georgia, where this editorialist was wringing his hands over what to do, they came up with an idea, and that was that anyone who wanted to recruit a single black person in the South had to first pay a licensing fee of $25,000 during the World War I era. Now, you know, that's an astounding number now, but in today's dollars, that would have amounted to $500,000 to recruit a single black person. I mean, who would do that? Who would pay that kind of money to recruit anyone? But that was what was created in the South to try to keep people from leaving. Now, it's interesting that the people in the South, the powers that be, it didn't appear that it occurred to anybody to maybe pay the people. You know, that might be, you know, a revolutionary thing. But one planter proudly announced to Labor Department officials who were doing research to try to understand what was going on at the time, because this was a very big deal when this was unfolding. This planter said, "I figured out how to keep my people to stay, how to keep these workers staying." He said, "What I have done is I've put away my whip and my gun, and I think they'll stay now." Now, that says so much. First of all, it says he was using a whip and a gun on, remember, we're not talking slavery. This is three generations from the end of slavery that we're talking about. We are well into the 20th century, and this planter actually believed that the way to prevent this migration from continuing was to put away his whip and gun, and that alone would keep the people from going. But of course, as you know, and as you can go to any state of the Union, and any city in the North, the Midwest, and West, obviously this great migration, the effort to stop it did not work. There are African Americans all over this land as a result of this great migration, and the people ended up leaving to such a degree that when this migration began, 90% of all African Americans were in the South. By the time it was over, half were all over the rest of the country. It was a complete redistribution of an entire people. So I want to tell you a little bit about some of the about the impact that this migration had on the entire country. The impact that it had was massive. And one of the things I should say is that this migration happened in a very, in a fairly orderly way, far more orderly than people think. In the same way that if you were to go to Minnesota, you'd find that there are a lot of people from Scandinavia. This migration, and any migration actually, many migrations occur in fairly orderly fashion. In other words, you can almost predict where a person is from based upon the city in the north or the Midwest where you happen to be. You can almost predict where that individual's family is from based upon where they happen to be. So this means that each migration has its own stream, beautifully predictable as human beings often can be. And the migration streams for the United States were one that went up the East Coast, and that meant people from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia who went to Washington, D.C., and to Philadelphia, and to New York, and on up to Boston, and straight on up the East Coast. There was a Midwest stream which carried people from Mississippi, and Alabama, and Tennessee, and Arkansas, to Chicago, and Detroit, and the entire Midwest. And then there was the West Coast stream, which carried people from primarily Louisiana and Texas to California, to Seattle, and I have to add Alaska. Now, of course, there are many variations within all of that, and particularly with Alaska. Alaska draws people from all over the world, and particularly with the role of the military, you would have people from all over. But primarily, that stream is carrying people from Texas and Louisiana up the West Coast, and that is the way that it is, because that's what human beings do. They go where people have gone before and where they can create colonies for themselves. Now, in the New World. Now, the effect of this migration is manifold, and one of the reasons that I find any migration so inspiring is that when people migrate, they don't do it for themselves. They really are doing it often for the children and the unseen grandchildren and the unseen great-grandchildren, which is where all of us come in. You know, all of us in some ways being the products of a migration, whether from a great-grandmother who crossed the Atlantic in steerage and met a great-grandfather who was from Italy or from Germany or from Poland or Lithuania or from China or from Japan or from wherever in this world multiple streams arrive into this country, those combinations create whole new lineages and mean that people who wouldn't even have existed exist as a result of migration, which is an astounding thing when you think about it. I have to say that I myself am a product of multiple streams of two people who came together who would never have met otherwise. In that way, I'm like many, many Americans who simply would not even have existed had there not been the courage and the fortitude and the vision or the adventurous nature of individuals to set out for places that were far, far from home. And so many Americans would not even exist as they currently are, had two people or people in our backgrounds not done what the people in this book did. In my own case, my mother is from Rome, Georgia. And my father was from Petersburg, Virginia, and they came up during multiple different years, would never, ever have met had there not been a great migration. And like so many people, they met, married, had me, and I'm an individual who would not even have existed. And so migrations often occur not really for the people who are doing the migrating, because for many people who migrate, migration is what people do when they are setting out at the beginning of adulthood generally. They generally tend to be teenagers or in their early 20s, but they are people who have already endured whatever whatever are the deprivations of wherever they happen to be, or the limits of wherever they happen to be. If they had to suffer the lack of education or limited education or malnutrition or limited nutritional options or limited access to health care, whatever it might have been, in some ways it's too late to make up for that by the time they're in their 20s. But it's not too late for the children, and it's not too late for the unseen grandchildren and the unseen great-grandchildren, which is where we all come in. Now, so that means that the way that you measure the effect of a migration is what happens to the children and the grandchildren. And in this particular migration, as in almost every migration, it changes everything.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. She was recorded speaking at UAA on January 26th.
In this particular migration, this is the first time in American history that the lowest caste people in our country, African Americans, had options, showed that they had options, that they were willing to take them. That had never happened in the history of our country before this migration began. The migration began again in World War I, generations after the end of the Civil War, which putatively should have freed the people, but actually did not. And so this was the first time that this group of people showed that they had options, were willing to take them, and did. It's also the first time in American history that the lowest caste people actually had the chance in large numbers to be what they chose to be, not be what they were assigned to be as a result of the caste system into which they had been born. In other words, if you think about it, if you think about the long history of the servitude of African Americans in this country, working in the fields, working in all those fields, whether the cotton fields, the sugarcane fields, the rice fields, or the tobacco fields, working in those fields were actually opera singers, orthopedic surgeons, dentists, and lawyers, architects, accountants. But because they were actually born into a caste system, they were working in the field. And they had never been able to live up to whatever God-given talents they actually had within them. And so therefore, these people never had the chance to work as the orthopedic surgeons that they actually might have been inside of them. They had to work the field. Think of all of the lost talent wasted for generations upon generations upon generations on that side of the caste system. And then think about the lost opportunities and that occurred on the other side of the caste system by those people who may have perceived themselves as beneficiaries of the caste system. In other words, they were running and created the caste system, and yet they lost out a tremendous amount. First of all, there are many people who might have been wonderful friends but never had the chance to be because there was this divide between black and white. There are people who had to expend so much energy to maintain a caste system to hold other people down. And that means if you're spending all this time holding someone else down, you're not able to rise as high as you could because it takes energy to hold other people down. It takes energy to hold thousands of people down and to the degree that was necessary in order to enforce the caste system that the South had. So this was wasted energy and wasted talent on all sides of the caste system. And yet, with this great migration, when these people finally left, finally, they had the opportunity to be what they chose to be. And while they may not have themselves been able to take true advantage of that, their children did. And some of those children became people such as Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison, the novelist, had her parents not migrated. They actually left Alabama for Lorain, Ohio. Had they not done that, their daughter would not have been able to do something that we all take for granted, and that is just to walk into a library and take out a library book. That was not legal. That was not allowed for African Americans in Alabama, which is where she would have been raised had they not migrated. And when you think about the works of August Wilson, who would not even have existed had there been no Great Migration, the playwright, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, whose entire cycle of plays were based upon The Great Migration. Every single one of his plays, if you've ever seen Fences, if you have seen The Piano Lesson, all of those plays are about the tensions, the losses, the heartache, the heartbreak, the homesickness, and all of the tensions north and south between cultures of those who stay and those who leave. That is what his entire body of work was devoted to. When you think about the works of Lorraine Hansberry and A Raisin in the Sun, that play is about the Great Migration. It's about people who have left the South, arrived in the big city of Chicago, the head of the household passes away, and the family is left bereft as to what will we do now and how will we make a go of it in this new land. And so this had an impact on our entire, on 20th century culture when it comes to literature. When you think about the work of Invisible Man, the great masterpiece of Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man is about someone who leaves the South, goes to the city of New York, and finds himself invisible. It becomes, in some ways, a symbol of the experience of the migrant trying to make a way for himself in an alien land, which is the story of the Great Migration, the story of every migration. That's just in literature. And then when you think about music as we know it, 20th century American music as we know it, simply was changed forever as a result of this Great Migration. Much of what we view as 20th century music simply wouldn't have existed had there been no Great Migration. Motown, for example. Motown would not have existed had there been no Great Migration. And that's because the founder of Motown, Berry Gordy, his parents migrated from Georgia to Detroit, which is where he grew up. And when he grew up, he decided he wanted to go into music, but he didn't have the resources to go out and to get the best talent around the country. So what did he do? He looked around himself in the city of Detroit, and there he was surrounded by children of the Great Migration, children who were growing up in this new world. Their parents were from the South, an altogether different country, one might say, and the parents had brought with them the memories and the music of the South. They had brought with them the blues and the spirituals and the gospel music that they had grown up with. And the children were growing up with that, and they decided to reconstitute it and turn it into their own, something of their own making. And he saw these three girls, for example. One was named Mary Wilson, another one was named Florence Ballard, and then there was a third one who was as known as well for her personality as for her singing. And I think some of you may have an idea of whom I'm speaking. That's Diana Ross. She would not have existed. We would not even know her name had there been no Great Migration. Her father was from West Virginia. Her mother was from Alabama. They met in Detroit, had arrived in Detroit during different years, met, married, had her and her sister, and a whole new legend was born, one might say. This Berry Gordy also heard about this very large family in a place called Gary, Indiana, which is not far from Chicago. There were 9 or 10 kids, and out of those 9 or 10 kids, there were 5 boys in particular who were very talented, and was the youngest one who was the most talented of all. He was the front man for the 5 boys, the 5 brothers at age 5. And I think you might have an idea who I'm speaking of. I'm speaking of a man named Michael Jackson, who would not have existed. He nor his brothers and sisters would not have existed had there been no Great Migration, because his parents wouldn't have met. The mother was from Alabama, father from Arkansas, met outside Chicago, married and moved out to Gary, had the kids, and yet another legend was born. When it comes to jazz as we know it simply wouldn't have existed. That's starting with Miles Davis, for example. Miles Davis, his parents were from Arkansas. They migrated to Illinois, where he got the chance, the luxury, one might say, of being able to build upon and to practice and learn music in a way that would never have been possible in the cotton country of Arkansas had his parents stayed. And Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated from North Carolina to Harlem when he was 5 years old, and he too got the luxury, really the unimaginable amount of time that it would have taken to hone his genius simply would not have been possible had his parents stayed in the tobacco country of North Carolina. And John Coltrane migrated from North Carolina to Philadelphia, at the age of 17, where, believe it or not, it wasn't until he got to Philadelphia that he got his first alto sax. And you wonder, when you think about it, where would jazz be if that man had not gotten hold of an alto sax, just one individual? And then you think, where would not just jazz, but where would music be had that man not gotten hold of an alto sax? And then you think, where would American culture, 20th century culture be? Not just for him, but for all the people that I've mentioned who were just the tip of the iceberg of the examples that indicate the wellspring of creativity and talent that was able to flourish for the first time in American history as a result of the single decision of a parent or an individual who had not even become a parent yet to make a decision to leave all that they'd known for a place that they'd never seen in hopes that life might be better. And the decisions of these people leading to opportunities for their children ended up being gifts not just to the United States, but to the world. These people whose names I've given you, from Toni Morrison to Ralph Ellison to John Coltrane to Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, these people are as revered in Paris and in Tokyo as they are here in the United States. I went to the Netherlands, and there were, to speak about this book, I've been all over, privileged to have been able to be all over, and there were pictures of these people all over, particularly the jazz musicians. They're perhaps more popular there than they are here. These were gifts to the world that occur as a result of any migration. And I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts that I hope will be inspiring to all of us as we go about our own personal journeys wherever they may take us, and also to reflect on what it took for all of us to be here. And that is the fact that any migration ultimately is the combination of individual decisions. This migration, the Great Migration, for example, was a decision that was a migration that occurred as a result of the decisions of 6 million people, individual people. One person added to another person, added to another person, created ultimately what we might consider a movement. In other words, this migration was in some ways shows the power of the individual decision, what the impact of one person deciding that they want something better for themselves can actually change the world. So much of our attention, just as a culture, focuses on a single hero, whomever that hero might be. And a lot of times right now we think of heroes, I mean, as a culture we think of heroes as famous celebrities who that we look to find out what's the latest that they're doing. And I'd like to believe that there's a way to look at another definition of hero. Look inside our own families, look inside ourselves, and find that there are heroes within all of our backgrounds that can serve as greater inspiration than any external hero might ever be. In fact, when you think about Martin Luther King, which is one of the reasons, and this is the time of year when we think of him and we honor him, the ultimate impact of what he did and the major contributions that he, this astounding individual and legend in our own history, did ultimately occurred because there was an advance guard to help prepare the way for what ultimately was the freedom rights movement and the equal rights movement that he represented and that he ultimately led. In other words, 6 million people from that region that had held people down for so long voted with their feet. And by voting with their feet, they put pressure on the North and the South ultimately to change. And the pressure that they put on the North and the South ultimately to change helped to create, helped to lift the burden of this shameful period in our history, and freed in some ways the entire country. If you think about it, oftentimes the United States gets involved in world conflicts because there's a large percentage of people here in this country that are from that part of the world, and it puts pressure on the United States to take action. And it's the same that occurred during the Civil Rights era. There had been pressures, and there had been efforts to overcome and to resist this caste system for generations, for centuries. But it is as if they were, it was as if they were trees falling, but no one there to hear them. As a result of 6 million people leaving and going all over the rest of the country, that forced the North to pay attention to what was going on in the South. And that's when the cameras went down. That's when the reporters went down. And they began to record resistance that had been going on for so long, reached a crescendo with the leadership, under the leadership of Martin Luther King, who himself had been a part of the migration when he went to Boston University for graduate school, came back home and decided, why can't we have in our own homeland what people have in other parts of the country? And so ultimately, together, all of these things were necessary to create what I view as the human rights movement in this country. Ultimately, this was a leaderless revolution, though, when it comes to this great migration and all of these things coming together. In some ways, it's about the power of the individual. It's almost as if these people said to themselves, which is what would have happened with any group of people who ever left one place for another, one way or the other, people have to think this way. Perhaps that's how the people crossed the Bering Sea in order to get here to Alaska. But someone in this particular migration, all of these people came on there to their own individual decision, and they said to themselves, they did not get together. There was no leader telling them the day or the hour, but somehow the people knew there are too many of us concentrated in this one area. Here in the land of our birth, while we do not want to go, but here in the land of our birth, our work is devalued, our very lives are devalued. Perhaps we will fare better elsewhere. And so they set out for all points, north, midwest, and west. And in that way, these people were able to do what a president of the United States could not do, Abraham Lincoln. These people were able to do what the Emancipation Proclamation could not do. These people were able to do what both houses of Congress could not or would not do. These people were able to do what the powers that be, North and South, could not or would not do. They freed themselves. They freed themselves. And that is power. That is the power of the individual, and that's the power that resides within each of us if we can merely tap the power within us. And so I wanted to leave you with the words of one of the great novelists of the 20th century, Richard Wright, and it is his words that inspired the title of this book, The Warmth of Other Suns. And it was his words that he wrote as he was reflecting upon his own moment of departure. He ended up leaving Mississippi for the warmer sun, or what he hoped would be the warmer sun of Chicago, a place called Chicago, in 1927. And in doing so, he wrote these words, which in some ways can be an inspiration for any of us as we are setting out on any journey, whatever that journey might be, returning to school, starting a business, setting out on a course for someplace new, anything that we might be doing. And so he wrote these words, and they are these. I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom. Now, when you think about the words that he wrote, one of the great ironies of what these people did and what all of us do, and I can almost feel this wind coming behind me that must be some part of the exterior 12 degrees Fahrenheit below that's coming in. And what an irony that these people chose to leave the warmest part of our country to come to what they perceived to be the warmer sun of Chicago, Boston, Anchorage. That means they desperately wanted freedom wherever it was and what by whatever name it would come. And that shows the determination. And when you think about this, I want to leave you with this one moment, and this is the moment of departure, which had to happen and all of our backgrounds just for us to be here. This moment of departure was the moment where a young person, whomever that might have been in all of our backgrounds, even if it was us, someone had to look into the eye of the person who raised them. Someone had to be at a dock about to board a ship from some port in Europe or a port somewhere in Asia or crossing the Rio Grande or they were at a train depot in Mississippi or Alabama or in Georgia or in Texas or at a bus station or someplace heading for a place that they did not know, where they did not know what was to become of them, but it had to be better than where they happened to be. And at that moment of departure would have been the people who raised them, their mother, their father, their grandparents, an aunt, an uncle, a big brother, whomever it might have been. And that older person could not make the crossing. This is a young person's endeavor, and the young person was going to have to go. The young person had determined that it was best for them to leave. And they had to look into the eye of the person who'd raised them, not knowing if or when they would ever see that person again. Remember, there was no Skype, no email, no cell phones. Not even reliable long-distance telephone service. The next time that this individual, this young person, might hear of or know of anything that had occurred with the person who'd raised them, their loved one, was if they got a telegram saying that their father had passed away or that their mother was ill and that they were to return home quickly if they were to see her alive. That is the magnitude of the sacrifice that had to have occurred in all of our backgrounds, where if we look far enough or even look closely enough, it had to have happened just for us to be here. And if you think about what they did with absolutely nothing, limited education, limited opportunities, limited access to healthcare, all the things that, and often political repression, all of these things propelling them to make a decision, a leap of faith into the unknown, then that means that we have heroes within our own backgrounds who can give us the answers to even our modern day problems. That we come from people who had answers and had a clarity of thought and faith that if we can just tap it, there are no limits to what we ourselves can do. So thank you so much for having me, and I so look forward to taking your questions. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. Following her talk, recorded at UAA on January 26th, Isabel responded to questions from the audience.
Hello, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I don't know if you can hear me, but...
Yes.
Oh, okay. I did have a question. You had mentioned Richard Wright departed the South in 1927?
Yes.
Was he from Mississippi?
He was from Mississippi. He went through Memphis and went to Chicago.
Do you have, across your research, did you run across the Great Flood of Mississippi in 1927?
1927.
And the Exodus did that affect his decision to leave, or...
He was from Natchez, Mississippi, and he wrote extensively about his feelings about the South, the oppression that he and his family had experienced, and he left because of the repression that he and his family had experienced in the South.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hello.
I have two questions. Mm-hmm. The first question is, are you aware that blacks have been coming to Alaska as early as 1860, 1870? There was a gentleman here who used to do a symposium, and it was called Blacks in Alaska. That he's dead now. He passed within the last 2 years. But I found that to be very interesting before the development of the Panama Canal, that they had to go around, actually, around South America and come all the way up.
That's a long ride.
That's a long ride. And once they got here... I guess they figured it was no reason to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty smart. And the documentation that he had with the emergence of the native population was very interesting for me. My second question is, Do you think that we are at the beginning of a re-immigration back to the South, and for various reasons, because we have saturated the need for our migration north, some of the cultural reasons I think should be apparent as far as going south in the way that children are reared and the family structure that we brought north with us has dissipated in urban settings. So my question is, do you think there's going to be a re-immigration, and are we at the beginning of that right now?
As to your second question first, there's what's called a reverse migration, which I refer to as a return migration. It has been underway since the Great Migration ended in 1970. The Great Migration that I described to you, which began in World War I and redistributed an entire people, ended in 1970. And from that point forward, any migration north or south involving African Americans was weighted in favor of the South. So we are 42 years into a return migration. And the return migration is in some ways a result of the Great Migration, because they have to be returning from some place, meaning they're returning from the places that the forefathers, meaning the parents and the grandparents of the Great Migration generation, where they went. These people went to New York, they went to Chicago, they went to Detroit, they went to Cleveland, they went to Seattle, they went to Los Angeles, they went to all these different places. And now their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren have an opportunity which they would not have had before, and that is to return to a South that is more welcoming for people of all backgrounds, because the South ultimately changed as a result of the pressure that was put to bear when you had this advance guard of 6 million people leaving, and you had the final act of pushing the country toward ultimate change through the civil rights legislation in the 1960s. And then, and only then, did the people begin to return. And when we say return, often the original people who migrated did not return, but it's their children and their grandchildren, and also people of all backgrounds, people who had not been there before. There are more Asian Americans who've living in parts of the South than there had been before. There are Latino Americans who are living in parts of the South where they had not been before. And there are many Northern whites who have said many, many times, and even just to me in the course of this book tour, that they would never have moved to Charleston, South Carolina, or to Atlanta, or to Houston, or to other parts of the South, had the South been as it was before, with the colored-only signs and with all these rules that are hard to remember if you're not raised in that world. And so it's a more welcoming place for everyone. When it comes to your first question about the presence of African Americans going back to the 1860s and 1870s in Alaska, one of the things about the beauties of humanity is that people have been migrating for a long time. This great migration that I'm speaking about was an outpouring of so many people with such a velocity that it actually has a name, the Great Migration. But there had been African Americans. Remember, I said 90% were in the South. That means 10% were spread out all over the rest of the United States, from Maine to Alaska. And that means that there had been a small percentage of African Americans who were outside of the South for quite some time. In fact, the very first non-native to settle in, say, a place such as Chicago, happened to have been of African descent, I should say, Jean DuSable. And he was the one who actually settled Chicago for the first time. And believe it or not, a lot of people are not aware of this. I was not aware of this before working on this book, that the first non-native settler of what we now call New York City was actually a person of African descent, Portuguese and African descent, and his name was Jan Rodriguez. And he settled, he had actually been abandoned by a Dutch merchant ship in the early 1600s, had been left there, And when they returned, it turned out he had actually lived. He actually survived and actually had created a trading post in what we now call Manhattan. And a lot of, there's a marker to him in Manhattan, but a lot of people are not aware of that. So as we can see, I mean, there are people of all backgrounds who have been, who settled this country, this continent, and other parts of the world in ways that are hard to imagine. I mean, we now can get on a plane, and it still took me 9 hours to get here from Atlanta. And it's astounding that, you know, centuries ago there were people. So thank you so much for having me, and it's been a pleasure to be here.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. Her talk, hosted by UAA Student Activities, was recorded in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium at the University of Alaska Anchorage on January 26, 2012. Special thanks to Kathleen McCoy and Jeff Oliver over at UAA for recording the event. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.